From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
I don't know if you've heard this, but here at Fragmented, we love CI services, which is why I'm extremely thrilled today to announce a new sponsor that has been on our radar and we have loved for a long time, Bitrise. Bitrise is mobile continuous integration and delivery for your whole team. And one of the things to love with Bitrise is the dozens of integrations that they have. They take a very different approach where you don't actually have to do a lot of scripting yourself. Instead, you can just keep tacking on a whole bunch of these integrations that they already have available. Head on to bitrise.io/integrations and you'll find a page with a whole bunch of integrations. UI testing, emulator testing, Android lint checks, publishing to the Play Store, they got them all. I'll point you to this blog post that they have called Introducing Solid and Snappy Virtual Device Testing for Android. So we care a lot about UI testing and it looks like Bitrise does too, which is awesome. Head on over to bitrise.io. It's a nice and simple URL, bitrise.io. Many thanks again to Bitrise for sponsoring today's show.
Kaushik, did you see that post by Airbnb recently?
Oh man, I am super excited. It is a topic that we have been discussing for some time. And you know, it's something that we have had many evolving thoughts on. The new one that our friend Gabriel wrote, that kind of blew up because it was very well written and it had some very interesting thoughts.
Yeah, the fact that that they were kind of moving on from React Native was a big surprise, I think, to both of us and to a large part of the community. So I think we've just felt it best to, since we've had Gabriel on the show here before, to get him on to talk about some of the things that helped Airbnb make that decision to go forward or not go forward with React Native. So without further ado, Gabriel, welcome back to the show.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's good to be here.
So Gabriel, let's just kind of hop right to it. We saw this post just recently and it was kind of just came out of left field. I really wasn't expecting it from Airbnb because Airbnb has kind of been one of the examples of how React Native has worked for you guys. And even back in one of the original episodes that we had you on, which is, I think the last one we had you on was episode 98, where I talked to you at DroidCon NYC 2017, we talked quite a bit about React Native. And one of the topics that was still sticks into my mind very clearly is how you stated that at times it felt like when you're developing React Native that, wow, this is amazing. This is going to be like the future, the way of developing. And then other times it was kind of painful. So when we saw the post here recently about how Airbnb is kind of deciding to move on from React Native, it was kind of amazing. So I was kind of wondering if you can kind of give us a rundown of what kind of kicked off that maybe discussion to determine it might be time to move on from it or why you're no longer using it.
Yeah, absolutely. So React Native is one in a long history of cross-platform frameworks for mobile. For a variety of reasons, cross-platform frameworks in the industry tend to bring out very strong reactions out of people.
Yes, they do. Yes,
to
they
say
do.
The least, yes.
Yes, people have many, many thoughts for many good reasons, right? They promise to do a lot. It's a huge investment for a company to have to write an app twice, essentially. Once for Android and once for iOS.
Yes,
absolutely.
And the ability to write it once for both platforms is obviously super appealing, both from an engineering perspective and also from a business perspective, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a challenge. Android and iOS are very different. They do different things. Some of the things they do that are the same on the surface are actually implemented quite differently under the hood. And so trying to marry those two together and build a great experience is a really hard problem. It's legitimately really hard. And I think a lot of people have tried doing it in different ways. One of the more recent ones being React Native, which takes some of the best from web and also the best from Android and iOS and tries to marry them all together. So it's something with a ton of promise. So we decided to make an investment in it. And I think we spent about almost 2 years on it in total, from
wow,
sort of the beginning ideation to working on infrastructure, many, many projects and screens. It was contrary to popular or many what many people thought. It was nowhere near 100% of our app. We continue to work in native. We continue to invest in it. We continue to hire for it and grow that team as well. But we also did React Native alongside and tried to make that a good experience. At the end of the day, we found that we weren't exactly meeting our goals with it for a number of reasons I touched on in the post and we can talk about later. But it's certainly not a black and white issue. And the decision to sunset it wasn't black and white at all.
Gotcha. So that's like a good point. I guess maybe we step back and then like, you know, just to get the framework right again, can you talk to us about like what the goals were with React Native? Like, why did you even invest in React Native, right? Like what's like, I'm sure Airbnb has like you said, like the native engineering team, the native mobile engineers probably had it all down. They knew how to do it all. But what was the idea? Like, why did you think of even going with React Native? Just so we can set the tone and then like, you know, understand why things went well and didn't go that well.
Let me also ask this to kind of pepper this on top as well. Was the decision that was made, was it from the engineering organization or was it from more of a upper management decision or recommendation?
Yeah, so the decision both to use it and to sunset it was basically entirely driven by engineering. Towards the beginning, it was sort of, or I should say here, like at Airbnb, engineers have a lot of autonomy to decide what technologies to use and what makes sense for a given project. If we go back to early to mid 2016, and we look at what the mobile landscape looked like at Airbnb, we had a fairly small mobile team. We were just starting to make that shift from having a single mobile team to have that team kind of sharded across each product team. So there were more vertical teams that had all the resources they needed to build their products. So mobile was small and it was growing. But as a percentage of the business, mobile was exploding and it was becoming extremely important. And we found that it was just legitimately difficult to keep up with the mobile needs of the broader organization. There were a lot of teams that wanted to start building things on mobile and they just simply didn't have the resources to do so. At the same time, our web was completing a transition to React. And React, if you just read around the internet and see what its adoption has looked like over the past few years, is genuinely one of the most loved frameworks ever built. I mean, I think it's rare to find a technology that people just legitimately like almost unanimously. And React seems to be one of those technologies. It scales extremely well. It's easy to learn. The life cycles are pretty simple. Then there's a pretty incredible ecosystem around it. And that was true here at Airbnb too. We've built a lot of infrastructure around it. We have a lot of people who know React and know Redux. And so for two engineers, Leland Richardson and Spike Brem, it just made a lot of sense to try to marry those two technologies together and leverage a lot of our existing expertise and existing infrastructure on mobile. So it seemed like a win-win situation.
Got it. So the primary motive was basically, hey, we have these developers on the web who have like this wealth of experience with React per se. And so the idea was like, okay, so React Native is something that could work. We'd be using the same language and like we can share this, develop this sort of shared knowledge base. And so eventually if everyone's working on the same thing, then we can just work off each other. Like that was like the primary goal.
Exactly. I think React as a sort of as a framework and as a paradigm has this methodology of learn once, write anywhere, which is a slight shift from what you hear of write once, run anywhere. So it gives people the ability to leverage the same skill set across different platforms.
There's a subtle nuance here. Maybe I'm misunderstanding this. It isn't necessarily that you're actually sharing the exact same code, which you might land up doing, but the drive towards why you started this was more towards, oh, we want to have people having it, like you wanted a shared knowledge base. And so that was the idea, right? It wasn't necessarily that, oh, we want to literally share the same code snippets across multiple platforms.
So it's a good question and one without also a black and white answer. This is where things are super complicated.
Right.
I think certainly the pattern learn once, write anywhere is quite true. The concept of write once, run anywhere is one that sort of could be true if you want it to be true, but it doesn't have to be true. So it's kind of complicated, whereas you could choose to share as much or as little code with web as you want. And so I would say from our experience, from a product perspective, our product and our infrastructure are sort of like our, I would say, runtime infrastructure is fairly separate between the two platforms. But towards the end of our experiment or our project with React Native, we started working with some teams that had a closer collaboration between mobile and web. And we were starting to see more shared resources between mobile and web. So we were just starting to get a taste of it, where we started to notice that things like Redux, reducers, and actions could start to be shared. So you could have similar state management and business logic between mobile and web, or certain libraries like our linting rules, some sort of build pipeline infrastructure stuff certainly could be shared. So it's the write once, run anywhere is a little bit more of a gray area where you can choose to do as much or as little as you want.
I could see that. I mean, there's so many different, I've talked to so many different companies that have used React Native, had their React Native, their React JS developers come over to React Native, build apps, share the components. And like you said, it's, you can use it two different ways. You can share the components or not, but the concepts remain the same. So it seems like during this, you know, this experiment, the project that you had was React Native, there was some things that probably worked pretty well. Would you mind talking about the things that you and Airbnb felt that worked well when you introduced React Native into your workflows?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and just to lay it out there, like there were absolutely times when everything seemed to come together, and the development experience and the quality of product that you could write with React Native blew anything we've ever seen out of the water. Like, wow. Seriously, it was incredible. If you could imagine sitting down and you write a new React component or you make a change to a screen, you hit save in VS Code, and then it shows up on Android and iOS. They look exactly the same in like 2 seconds, rather. There's no big compilation step. It doesn't have to reinstall an APK. React Native has this concept of hot module reloading. You can kind of think of it as like instant run for Android, except it actually works. And it's reliable, and you can count on it to work in when development, where it's, I mean, quite literally, even on an enormous code base with 100,000 lines of code or more, it really legitimately takes like 1 second. And that we've sort of, over the last couple of years, we've built up this thing we call DLS. It's a design language system, where our designers have a core set of components. They're cross-platform, but we make the proper UI affordances, changes where necessary to make it feel natural on each platform. But given that most of our screens have the same general overall feel with only nuanced differences, it really enabled us to write product code once for both platforms. And we found that actually in reality, most product engineers had somewhere between 95 and 100% shared code for the product.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's something that's often overlooked, but like it really did work. Like I would say that cross-platform code on the screen level, on the product level for the React components, absolutely. Like I think we achieved that shared code goal and it was extremely effective.
What would you say that's more along the lines related to your design language that you had set up at Airbnb? Or is it, because I feel like you can have iOS components and Android components. And if I want to go with the material style on Android and the iOS Cupertino widgets on iOS, then I feel like I'm not going to have as much shared code. Do you feel that the design language really helped you accomplish that 95, you know, or 98% parity?
Yes, absolutely. I think if you really wanted to go material on Android and Cupertino, whatever they call it, on iOS, and there were legitimate differences and other than just a light skinning on top of one another, which in fact I think would be the case if you tried to go that route, It's going to be a lot harder. You're not going to be able to, for obvious reasons, share nearly as much code. You may be able to start to share some of your business logic and whatnot, but at that point, the story for React Native becomes a lot less clear.
And just stepping back a little, the DLS thing that you mentioned, the design language system, right? For Airbnb, this is just so listeners understand, because even in your blog post, you do definitely talk about this. And I think there's another independent blog post from your design team where they talk about it. But this is essentially the equivalent of material design, but for Airbnb, right? This is like the set of shared components and design system for Airbnb that you use across all of your platforms.
Yeah, absolutely. So it includes everything from larger components to different kinds of rows and headers and marquees at the top of screens to that can be used and shared. And they have canonical names. And there's a team that owns the maintenance of these components to keep them up to date, all the way down to things like color palettes and fonts and sizes and paddings and grids and everything that sort of make them more foundational, the foundation of a screen, and help things feel unified across the platform.
Got it. So from the design perspective, it's essentially like the standard or the contract. And like also from the engineering perspective, you have teams that support having these in actual like widgets that you would use either in React Native or iOS or Android.
Yes. And I think this is a pattern that we're starting to see across companies as they scale. They start to put emphasis to build a set of core components for their design process. That being said, this is now where coming up, but it's been about 2.5 years. I think it was around the end of 2015 that we started working on DLS. And it's not an easy process to get to where we are today, where it's a fairly efficient and highly tuned beast of a design system, per se. It takes, just like investing in React Native or any of these things, it takes a lot of intentional work and dedicated people to really focus on making sure that they build the right set of components that actually solve problems of teams, and finding the balance where we've shifted different points on the scale of providing a lot of rigidity where you sort of are forced to design within this system and a lot of constraints, to being a little bit more flexible or opening it up to more teams contributing or streamlining the process of making changes to these core components or adding new ones. So for companies that are sort of going along this process, just know that it takes a lot of intentional work to make something like this work, but if you put in that work up front, it can definitely pay off.
I just want to clarify for the listeners too, if you're still not familiar with what the design language is, just think about it as a way to say, hey, look, this is how a button is going to look, and it's going to look the same way on iOS and on Android. This is how an edit text is going to look. It's going to look the same on iOS and Android, and that's going to be the Airbnb design language. And it's going to be different from a different company's design language, which they've created. And that's going to, of course, like as you've stated here so far, just help you kind of whip out these widgets and make these changes. And if you're using React Native, it just makes sense, because then you'd have to apply that once, and it's just going to fit both styles on the application.
I do want to add the caveat, though, for some people who might be like, oh my God, they're just like totally ignoring all the platform guidelines. That is super important for us that we also adhere to platform guidelines. We think here that it's super important that the app feels consistent relative to what you're used to, because you're going to be hopping between different apps on your platform, not between the same app on different platforms. No one's going to use the Android app for Airbnb and then immediately go and compare it to the iOS app. They're going to go and compare it to all their other Android apps.
Exactly.
And so we've actually built some of these differences into the design language system itself. And so things like disclosure arrows are common on iOS to show affordances on an actionable row. Those don't exist on Android. They're not part of the Android guidelines. So we have built into the components differences between the platforms. Or like the toolbar, for example. So we have a native toolbar on Android, native navigation, UI navigation bar on iOS, as well as things like screen transitions and a number of other things, so that it also feels at home on the platform.
Were you able as a team to use existing web tools that maybe some of the React folks had already been used to, such as some things like, you know, like Flexbox or like ESLint or Babel or anything like that, that maybe the web folks already are very familiar with?
Yes, and that's a really, really good point. So one thing I want to emphasize about React Native is that the React part of React Native is React. This is not a clone of React. It's not a React-like thing. It is the React code base verbatim. Wow. And there's a lot of shims underneath it to make it sit on top of mobile, but because it's just React, you can leverage basically the entire infrastructure and toolchain and community from React. And that's something that we definitely took advantage of. So we use things like ESLint to get pretty advanced linting. We used Babel to do sort of transpiling of our JavaScript so we could use all the latest ES6 features and bake in a number of other optimizations. And the entire open source community was huge. So we used things like Redux, Reselect for all kinds of things. So if you were to look at our package.json, it would look just like something you'd see on the web. And when we needed something, whether it be some utilities or things for a state, we could leverage the entire React community, which is huge. It's very supportive. And there's a lot of really mature libraries out there.
As I was reading your post, it was interesting because I noticed this section about like performance, right? And that's usually if you're having a coffee conversation with someone and like the idea of React Native comes in, almost typically everyone's like, oh yeah, but React Native, like, you know, the performance, it isn't there. Like, you know, you can use it for a settings page. And I mean, to be quite honest, I'm guilty of doing this as well, right? Because at a certain time, that was definitely the perception. And it was also what we saw, but this was early on. You had an interesting statement in that you said, like, rarely was performance ever a problem. Now, I know it's nuanced, but I was hoping you could, like, maybe touch on that as well, especially in terms of what worked well. Because if performance was not a problem, probably worked well then, right?
Yes. So we should say, just like with most things in React Native, I think performance actually in particular is something where it's not black and white. So when people think about React Native performance, I think that they think about jank, they think about like just things feeling slow or cumbersome.
Smoothness,
or just like a not as buttery smooth, anything but a buttery smooth UI. But in reality, I think the performance question is much more nuanced than that. So if we think about just from that perspective, that initial thought about the actual layout and the views and everything, let's talk about that, and then we'll talk about a couple other things as well. But from this perspective, most Android apps today do most of their work on the main thread. So you have things like layout, you have business logic, you have some draw actions on the main thread, and you have to fit it all in 16 milliseconds or else you're going to start dropping frames, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in React Native, the way that it works is you do your business logic in JavaScript. So it runs on a JavaScript thread. And then the React reconciler runs and it creates a list of basically view operations with a flexbox, which is like a sort of a modern CSS way of laying things out. It's quite powerful and easy to learn. I think it's easier than the Android layout system to learn, but still very powerful. And then it serializes those and it sends those to a library called Yoga. So Yoga is a C or C++ library written by Facebook as well that they use for cross-platform layout. It's a cross-platform layout engine that takes Flexbox as the input and then it spits out layout commands on each platform. So it's the underpinning of React Native. It's also the underpinning of ComponentKit or Litho or some of the other Facebook libraries so that they have consistent rendering and fast rendering. So now your layout also happens off the main thread because of Yoga. So we've moved business logic off the main thread, we've moved layout off the main thread, and then it serializes it and it sends those layout commands to the main thread, and it actually frees up the main thread to do more or less just that last absolute layout rendering and whatnot. It gets a little bit challenging when he starts to think about some of the implications of that. So now the layout itself, because it goes through this translation process from Flexbox through Yoga to the main thread, it's kind of a black box, and you don't really know what it's going to spit out on the other side. It's pretty good, and it's getting a lot better over time. So it does a lot of things like view component tree coalescing. So even if you have a really deep component hierarchy in React Native, it's actually going to flatten that to basically, if it can, all the way down to just a single absolute layout with one layer of children inside of it. Can't always get all the way down to that, but it actually, in many cases, can. And it's getting better. Or you can even be explicit in React Native and you can create a component that you explicitly do not want to be backed by a view, or if you do want it to be backed by a view, so you can actually do a lot of optimizations there. That being said, it's still hard to tell sometimes, and there are times when if at the end of it goes into the black box and comes out and it's janky, it can be really hard to know why. It can be really hard to know what subtle layout thing or what exactly it's doing or how to fix it and make it less janky. You don't have as many direct levers to pull to make the UI itself more responsive if it's not.
It's kind of one of those trade-offs.
Yeah, exactly. So unless you're doing things with really, really long lists or whatnot, we actually didn't see very many performance issues specifically related to scrolling jank. But when we did, you might think that they're related to layout or React Native being slow, but in fact, they were frequently related to subtle errors of using Redux or React in such a way that it was causing the screen to re-render way too many times.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So, and these are not React Native specific. The same thing, the exact same thing would happen on web. But if you're familiar with React, it has this ability to determine whether if state and props update, you can tell it whether or not it should re-render. And so there were times where, let's say, something not wired up correctly somewhere, and you could potentially introduce subtle bugs like re-rendering the entire screen every time you type a letter into a text box, for example.
Oh, I see.
And the solution may be just a couple of lines of code, but the difference is, like, you might write it the first time, not be aware of the possibility of such a problem or not know how to diagnose it, think React Native is super laggy, when in fact, if you just change one thing and make the screen not constantly re-rendering, it'll go straight to 60 FPS. So, and then I think there's a second half to the performance story, which is the initialization and startup time. So there's two sides to the story. There's the React Native initialization itself, where it starts at the runtime and it gets everything ready to render that first screen. And we saw a wide range of times for that. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now. They're in the blog post, but they are in many cases on the order of seconds. On Android, it's quite a bit faster on iOS, I should note. But on Android, especially on slower devices, it's definitely on the order of seconds. So if you have an app and you're trying to optimize cold start time, but the first screen in your app is React Native, then you're kind of screwed because you kind of have to just sit there and wait for a long time for it to start up.
Right. And just to add context, from the blog post, you said, there's an artificial delay of approximately 50 milliseconds, right, between for transitions as well, right?
Exactly. So that's the second half of the startup performance for React Native. And it ties back to the earlier performance thing we were talking about, where all your business and layout logic happen off the main thread. And so unlike normal Android, where you can synchronously render that screen, you actually have to do a couple of thread hops before you get that first render pass back to draw. And so this can cause a few issues. So on Android, for example, in order to make window animations smooth, it locks the view hierarchy, and your view hierarchy won't lay out while there's a window animation happening. And we used one activity per screen on React Native, which seems to be a pattern that a lot of people have been following. But one of the side effects of that is that if you start a screen, that window animation for the new screen is going to come in before that first render happened. And
So there's a flicker of sorts. Yeah.
Exactly. So you'll see a white window come in, and then your content will pop in after that. So we actually use the shared element transition API as a hack to postpone shared element transition at the beginning and then resume it after that first render happened. And then on iOS, we added an artificial delay of 50 milliseconds to every new screen on iOS. So really, it's really unfortunate, and it is a side effect of this multi-threaded system.
See, this you had somewhere in one of the posts. I think it said your team had written close to 200,000 lines of code or something like that, or 20,000. It was quite a bit of code, regardless. And I can imagine there had to be a bunch of lower level components which I'm wondering how you handled that. And what I mean by that is, how did you handle like networking, internationalization? All kinds of stuff like that. Was that per platform? Did you handle that, or did you write kind of just, hey, we're going to do all the networking for React Native. We'll just do it in JavaScript, and then if we need to do some regular native Android stuff, we'll use whatever things we're using in Android. Or how did you manage that across both of the platforms?
That is a good question, and I think for different companies, it's going to depend on the state of your app and what your goals are. But for us, we have native infrastructure teams working on Android and iOS to build all of these tools, like you said, internationalization, shared element transitions, networking, all of that stuff. And we didn't want to reinvent the entire world with React Native. We wanted to build bridges to the existing infrastructure and then wrap them in a single canonical React API so that they could be used by product engineers in React and not have to worry at all about what platform they're on. Yeah, we could still leverage all the new performance improvements. So there are a couple of things to consider here. For things like networking, it's really good that we can use the same networking stack, because then they can do things like share the same cache. This is really important if you have what we call a brownfield app, where you have some native screens and some React Native screens. And if you're hopping back and forth between them, you don't want there to be performance overhead or network overhead of the underlying platform sort of bleeding its implementation detail up to the end user experience. But if you have more of a greenfield app where you're 100% React Native, maybe it's better to just write that infrastructure once. But again, for us, if we had done it all in JavaScript, we would end up writing a third set of all the infrastructure. And this may be feasible, or you might be able to think it's a reasonable thing to do if you're just like adding React Native to your app. But as your company grows and it scales, you're going to have like a new version of your API or a new version of implementation library. You're going to add new details to the way images are fetched to have multiple sizes or whatever new features that the other infrastructure teams are building. And you're going to be playing a constant game of catch up if you're trying to,
right,
to rewrite all of those features in JavaScript. That being said, it's still a game of catch up writing the bridges, but writing the bridges, I think, is a little bit easier than rewriting the infrastructure itself.
You said something that I want to wonder if you can explain to the listeners, because some folks have troubles with these terms. One was brownfield and another one is greenfield. Would you mind explaining what both of those terms mean and kind of where, which of them that Airbnb fell into?
Yeah, so this is a term coined by Leland Richardson, which is one of our other engineers who worked in React Native and has since moved to Google, which, by the way, has nothing to do with us sunsetting React Native, despite what some people might assume. but Greenfield is an app where you're starting fresh with one platform. You can go 100% React Native. You can build everything around React Native. Brownfield is where you have Native and React Native living alongside in one app. So we had a large existing app, native app, at Airbnb, and we weren't about to force all of our engineers to use React Native. By the way, if you try to do that, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
They will hate you for it, most likely. So we definitely continue to invest in both. And so this split world, native and React Native, we call brownfield.
Okay. Just another quick follow-up to what you mentioned with respect to like sharing like the native sort of resources, especially like things like the caching layer, for my understanding. So this is basically what you mean is like sharing, say if I was using, Retrofit or like, you know, Room or something. I'm not saying Airbnb uses it right now, but if you did, the idea is you would write a bridges in React Native that would communicate to these same layers in Android. And you would have to have like those similar bridges to write something that would communicate in the equivalent of iOS and maybe web, right? So the bridges would have to be written three times again to bridge with the native variant. You don't mean like a native C layer kind of networking thing that you share across all platforms, right?
Correct. Exactly. So React Native as a library, the actual framework of React Native has a tool that allows you to create essentially an interface where you have one side in JavaScript and then you have parallel implementations in Java or Kotlin and then Swift or Objective-C on each respective platform, where you can make calls across the two platforms. Things have to be serialized in such a way, and they can be a little bit cumbersome to write. However, I should note that that Facebook has acknowledged that this is a challenge, and they published their own blog post with some of the things that they're looking forward to doing over the next year in React Native, and making this process of creating a bridge easier and more reliable is something that they are, in fact, focused on.
Now, I've created a number of these bridges actually for some clients that I have that are doing some brownfield development with React Native. And I had a question for you. How did you organize these bridges? Did you put the bridges all in one location, or were the bridges kept like per feature, or what did that look like? Did you include them with the particular activity? Because I've done a few ways online. I'm interested to know how Airbnb did it and if there's any benefits to any of the approaches that you used.
So we have a pretty modular code base where we have about 110 Gradle modules in our code base right now, or Buck, which we also use. But we basically had all of our React infrastructure in a single React module.
Okay.
And similarly on iOS. To be honest, we didn't try another way, so it's hard for me to... It would never really cause us any major problems. I think it was sort of convenient since it was basically one team that was writing all the bridges.
Mm-hmm.
It worked out pretty well that they were all in one place.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
And I imagine also like the thing like instant app plus plus or whatever, the hot reload stuff also made it easy. So you didn't actually face any of like the problems with like that you would typically expect with like proper Gradle without having proper Gradle modularization, right?
Right. I mean, of course, if you modify a bridge, you have to update the underlying app itself so they communicate. Otherwise, it'll just crash.
Fair enough. All right, folks. As you might have guessed, this is a topic that Don and I are extremely curious about, and we have many, many questions, and we just went at it with Gabriel, who was extremely kind to indulge us for longer. So this concludes part one. In part two, which should be coming out pretty shortly, it's coming out pretty soon, we specifically talk about the parts that didn't exactly go as planned. If you read the original blog post that spawned this all, eventually Airbnb decides to sunset their use of React Native. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for that next part, in which we'll go into the details as to what exactly didn't work that well. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode. Once again, we want to thank our sponsor for today's show, Bitrise. Bitrise is a mobile continuous integration and delivery service for your whole team with dozens of integrations for your favorite services. Head on over to bitrise.io to find out more. Thanks again for sponsoring today's show, Bitrise. That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.